This is the Quality News Network. The summit between President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in Jordan today has been pushed back to Thursday. In today's New York Times, a confidential memo written by National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley after his recent trip to Iraq raised doubts about al-Maliki's leadership. The White House said the delay was not related to the memo leak. As expected to protest the meeting, Iraqi cabinet members loyal to anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shia, suspended their participation in the parliament. In Iraq today, fighting in Bakuba shut down the city as coalition forces battled insurgents. The U.S. military said 8 suspected al-Qaeda members were killed and 2 Iraqi women were killed as well. Also, the U.S. military reported 2 more American soldiers died in Iraq. To increase security, the U.S. military will move at least 3 more army battalions into Baghdad, according to a Pentagon official. That is around 3,000 troops. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell is calling the situation in Iraq a civil war. The White House refuses to characterize it as such. He adds that world leaders should accept that reality. Pope Benedict continued his first visit to Turkey today. He is seeking dialogue between faiths. Al-Qaeda in Iraq called the Pope's visit part of a, quote, crusader campaign against Islam. 2 British Airways planes at London's Heathrow Airport have tested positive for radiation traces. A 3rd plane is under examination. The testing is in connection with the poisoning death in London of Alexander Litvinenko, a critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. On Capitol Hill, in the opening weeks of the new 110th Congress, Democrats plan to revive the embryonic stem cell funding bill that President Bush vetoed, the first veto of his presidency. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist announced today that he will not run for president in 2008. The U.S. is cracking down on the sale of luxury products to North Korea, such as iPods and plasma televisions. The trade sanctions are meant to personally aggravate North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-il, who recently conducted a nuclear weapons test. 2 days before Mexico's president-elect Felipe Calderón will be sworn in, there was a brawl in the legislature's chambers. Leftist lawmakers may try to disrupt the inauguration ceremony. And Cuba's leader Fidel Castro is reportedly too sick to attend celebrations for his 80th birthday. You are listening to the Quality News Network.
Huelhauser talks to customers of First National, South Valley, and San Benito Banks, local members of the network of preferred community banks.
We're here to talk with people about their business banking. Here's a guy who not only banks at the bank, he helped build the bank building.
Yes, sir.
Do you find the fact that it's a local bank appealing?
Yes, that's just it. It was the local people in the community that originally started the bank, and that's why he got involved.
It's a local bank with big bank benefits. It's part of a network of banks. Does that mean anything to you?
Absolutely. Having a bank that can handle a big project really helps because some banks aren't tailored to handle big business, and they can handle the big business for sure. They have no limitations to what they can do for your business.
I do my business banking and my personal banking with them.
Both.
Absolutely.
You're double dipping.
You bet.
Above and beyond banking from the network of preferred community banks. Available locally at First National Bank of Central California, South Valley National Bank, and San Benito Bank.
Researchers in Amsterdam have found that even first-time users of the popular recreational drug ecstasy experience memory problems and decreased blood flow to the brain. It is not yet clear if this brain damage is permanent. Ford announced that nearly half of its hourly production workers, or 38,000, have agreed to buyouts or early retirement offers. Drug manufacturer Pfizer will cut 2,200 jobs from its U.S. sales force, or about 20%. The cuts are part of a cost-cutting program and will be made by the end of the year. One of the nation's largest textbook publishers, Houghton Mifflin, will be bought out for nearly $2 billion by a publishing executive. The new company will be called HM River Group. A federal judge has now ruled that a newspaper alliance involving the San Francisco Chronicle and several papers owned by the Media News Group may violate antitrust laws. A judge has ruled that paper money is unfair to blind people. The federal judge said the Treasury Department must come up with ways to differentiate the bill so that the blind can tell them apart. And San Diego City Council voted to ban certain large retail stores such as Walmart Supercenters. The mayor is expected to veto the ban. Light sweet crude is trading at $62.38 a barrel, and at the close of Wall Street today, the Dow was up 90 points, the Nasdaq was up 20 points, the S&P 500 up 13. There's always more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramoff.
Okay! Tokyo! South America!
Now, Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Oh, glory, it is Wednesday night. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid, tickled to death to be with you this evening, especially after our unexpected hiatus yesterday evening, at least evening Eastern time. You know how it goes. Apologies are in order. I'm sorry we missed, but my father became ill. He is presently hospitalized. And we took the time that we would have spent being on the air and producing Bruce's show to take him to the hospital. Turns out it's pneumonia, and they're treating him with intravenous antibiotics even as we speak, and he seems to be doing better. And we hope for... I love him to death. I want him home as quickly as possible, but no quicker than is necessary to get him on the road to recovery. Now, something happened. You know, have you... Something happened yesterday evening. I was talking to the emergency room physician, but of course it's worth reminding you what tonight is.
On this every other Wednesday afternoon discussion club, we are going to have more to discuss on this every other Wednesday afternoon than we ever had on any other every other Wednesday afternoon.
You know, somehow I just we have to play that because I love the inescapable logic of the charming Lisa Douglas, Ava Gabor, the good Gabor. As opposed to the menacing Zsa Zsa. Last night when we went to the hospital, I had a sort of an object lesson in something, and the object lesson is that I suppose maybe it's because of so much exposure to right wing filth and hearing it on seeing it on the TV, hearing it on the radio. I can spot one a mile away now. And I found one in the emergency room physician at the hospital last night. Now, it's a complicated tale, and I won't go into all the specific details, or as we say around here, the Pacific details. I won't go into the specific details. However, suffice to say that I was having a conversation with the emergency room attending physician, and I asked him if he would check into another little problem that my father has been having. Yeah, nothing life-threatening, but certainly unpleasant and uncomfortable. And he looks at me and says, "Nope, won't do it." And he said, "He's been admitted for pneumonia and possible heart interaction. We can't do anything else." I said, "Oh, I get it. No, don't worry about it. Above your pay grade, right?" He goes, "No, government won't pay for it. They'll pay for the treatment for the pneumonia, but they won't pay for that." I said, "Lord, it will be nice when we get universal health care and don't have to worry about this foolishness." That is universal health care! You know, do you see what I'm saying? That you can spot them. You can spot them from a mile away. That's government medicine. Socialized boom. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I've got a live one. I got a ditto head here. I said, "Well, you know, call me crazy. I just think it's a shame that everybody in America can't go to the doctor when they're sick." "Oh, they go to the doctor all right. They come here all the time. They get a scratch and they come here and they got to get a Band-Aid." I said, "Well, you know, me, I'm on the drop-dead insurance program." He said, "Well, you know, that's kind of how I feel about it, too." And then Then comes the coup de grace of conservatism. After all, there are worse things than being dead.
There is.
And, you know, it was one of those moments where you have to just start, but dear Jesus, please don't let the Louisville Slugger appear in my hands and turn me into Robert De Niro right now, please. There's worse things than being dead. You know, you've been dead, you've come back. I mean, you got the beard. I didn't know you were Jesus. Yeah, I'm guessing he mailed it in medical school in that bedside manner class. Ah, there's worse things than being dead.
But.
Better button there if you want to be talking, dear.
But, dear, even for all the Grim Reapers that are out there, you know, you should have known who he was. He had the sigh carrying it when he walked in.
No. He looked like an ordinary Joe. I mean, it's you get the little code words here and there. That's government medicine.
Yeah.
But you realize there are still people who are dedicated to the profession.
I'm sure there are. But this guy was a horse's rear end. And, you know, you can tell. This is somebody who thinks that he has a God-given right to what? It was just offensive. And, you know, well, we won't talk about that. No, we all know that anybody who works for a living should be able to go to the doctor when they're sick so that they can continue working for a living, supporting their family and, you know, paying taxes. Because no matter how much they talk about, we got to cut your taxes. The Republican Party is absolutely dedicated to the proposition that working people, middle class people, must pay the taxes, because the Republican Party certainly doesn't want their buddies paying them. You know, our betters, the last 0.1% of the richest people in America, who control, what, something on the order of 70% of the wealth in this nation?
Ah, oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
No, that's what I'm on about. So, you know, we got home, the dad's doing okay, but that guy kind of pissed me off. I don't know, I'm thinking maybe he needs to join Doctors Without Borders and go and do some doctoring somewhere where he can't complain about the people who come through the door. I mean, but to be honest, to be fair, you know, this is a very rural state, and as a consequence, we don't have nearly the doctor's offices. We certainly don't have a quack in a shack or a doc in the box, or urgent care or whatever, on every corner. And when people get sick, they go to the emergency room, and it does tax the system, without a doubt. But then today, that all sort of went by the boards. But when I picked up the computer monitor and read the paper. No, I was over at browsing the Washington Post, and I found a comment by Nawaf Obaid. And Mr. Obaid is, among other things, an advisor to the Saudi government. In other words, is an advisor to the royal house of Ibn Saud. Also managing director of the Saudi National Security Assessment Project and an adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And he writes this opinion piece. It was found on page A23 of your hard copy of the Washington Post, if you'd like to sing along with the choir. And he writes, among other things, some of the stuff one tends to agree with. In February 2003, he writes, a month before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud al-Faisal, warned President Bush that he would be solving one problem, quote, solving one problem and creating five more. That's the line. If he removed Saddam Hussein by force. Well, you know, that wasn't just His Royal Highness Prince Saud al-Faisal saying that. There were lots of Americans who said that. His daddy told him that, for the love of God. Yeah, Son, there's a reason we didn't take out Saddam, because it would have destabilized the region. Yeah, Brent Scowcroft told him that. Colin Powell told him that.
Yeah, but he tried to kill my daddy, and I've lost my patience.
So, but anyway, so, you know, solving one problem, creating five more if he removes Saddam by force. And Mr. Obaid says, had Bush heeded his advice, Iraq would not now be on the brink of full-blown civil war and disintegration. True, true, okay, so I get through that paragraph and I'm all right. One hopes he won't make the same mistake again by ignoring the counsel of Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, who said in a speech last month that, quote, since America came into Iraq, this is the beauty. All of us who want the United States out of Iraq yesterday, you are entitled to an official purple polka-dotted blue screaming hissy as of right now. Turki Al-Faisal said in a speech last month, quote, since America came into Iraq uninvited, it should not leave Iraq uninvited. If it does, one of the first consequences will be massive Saudi intervention to stop Iranian-backed Shiite militias from butchering Iraqi Sunnis. But it was that line. Since America came into Iraq uninvited, it should not leave Iraq uninvited. And again, I find myself mentioning this from time to time just because I've got a pretty good memory and I remember the things that I talk about. I can't always put the date on it, but I do remember discussing it. And in the last few days and in the last week, we have discussed the fact that the Saudis are not going to put up with George Bush screwing up Iraq for very much longer at all. And I pointed out that I would not be surprised if the Royal House of Ibn Saud called Dear Leader on the carpet sometime soon, and that is precisely what happened when they made Bionic Dick Cheney fly umpty thousand miles from Washington, D.C. to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia for a nice dressing down on the carpet about the screw-up that's taking place in Iraq. But it was that line. Since America came into Iraq uninvited, it should not leave Iraq uninvited. On the one hand, that plays into the idea that I have put forward recently, that the one thing in the world we need to do most right now is set up a referendum, a one-question referendum in Iraq, let all Iraqis of relevant age vote upon it. And the single referendum be, do you want the United States to stay or do you want them to go? Majority rules, they say we go. It seems only fair. It's their country, after all. That part of that jibes with, you know, it should not leave Iraq uninvited, but it's this business of the Saudis telling us what we should or should not do in this mess that George Bush has made. And frankly, you know, I'm still not over September 11th. And I haven't forgotten that 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. And they weren't poor Saudis either. They were middle class or to upper class Saudis. I haven't forgotten that. I haven't forgotten the vast amounts of money, as reported accurately by Greg Palast, that a Saudi princess poured into the treasuries of organizations dedicated to hurting us. Now, I'm not gonna parrot all that right wing garbage. No, but the fact of the matter is, she was let go when she was a primary financier for the people who flew the planes into the buildings. And I haven't forgotten, as was accurately reported again by Greg Palast and others, the vast number of Saudis who were picked up from all over the country when nobody else could get off the ground in an airplane. These people were picked up and flown out of the country before any kind of significant debriefing could be done of them. So I bear no great love to the Saudi nation or royal family. You know what? I hate the Saudi SOBs. Okay, I do. I know that might rankle some, but I'm sick of them. I'm sick of I'm as sick of being wagged by this once great nation being wagged by the Saudis as I am sick of this once great nation being wagged by the Israelis. I don't want the tail wagging the dog. I don't like it. We're Americans. We'll wag when we want to wag, I guess. But I loathe the Saudis, I do. Not because they're Muslim, and not because they're Arabic. It's not racism. It's not intolerance for their religion. No. I loathe these rotten human beings because they're feckless. Hell of a word, huh? Feckless. And you know what? I loathe them because they're cowards. And because they're perfectly content to sit and let American mothers, sons, and daughters go on bleeding and dying while they recline in comfort. And because they ignore the miseries of Iraqi children who die for want of food and medicine and something as ordinary as clean water. And because they mistake the person of George W. Bush, their tool, for the character of our nation. You know, I don't know. Maybe they're incapable of understanding the nature of American personal sovereignty. Maybe they don't understand the idea of a republic based upon principles of representative democracy. Maybe the royal house of Ibn Saud is more in need of a dose of democracy than Iraq ever was. You know, it bears asking, where are, you know, never mind this endless foolish, the fool's errand of trying to build an Iraqi army. Where are the Saudi brigades ready to stand up so we can stand down? Where are they? They're nowhere. That's where they are. They're power brokering, yellow-bellied, gutless cowards. And I despise them. And maybe I despise them even more so if you go through the article by the possibility that they would dangle cheap oil before our eyes in exchange for a few thousand more shattered American families. We must leave Iraq now. Yesterday, if possible. No more of this highfalutin Washington babble speak about phased redeployment. Home is where the troops need to be, and home is here. We have thousands upon thousands upon tens of thousands, perhaps scores of thousands, of people who have served in that war who need services now. We're not getting them. And maybe, you know, if what I've said makes the slumber of some Saudi princeling a little less sound, that's just too bad, isn't it? It might very well. You tell me if I'm wrong, and I could be. I read this article, and my eyes filled with blood. I can't tell you how angry this opinion piece made me. And so, what the case is a little bit of head rolling. Some head-rolling revolution needs to take place on the Saudi Peninsula among the royal house of Ibn Saud more than it does anywhere else. Because go and read this again. Nawaf Obaid, page A23, today's Washington Post. Just a few months ago, it was unthinkable that President Bush would prematurely withdraw a significant number of American troops from Iraq, but it seems possible today, and therefore the Saudi leadership is preparing to substantially revise its Iraq policy. Options now include providing Sunni military leaders, primarily ex-Ba'athist members of the former Iraqi officer corps, who make up the backbone of the insurgency, with the same types of assurance, funding, arms and logistical support that Iran has been giving to Shiite armed groups for years. You know what? better them than us. Because again, I'll stand behind what I said. The Saudis are cowards. They were cowards when the Iraqi army poured into Kuwait in 1990. And they are cowards now. They have every single sophisticated piece of military hardware that we have available for sale, and we sell it to them by the boatload, literally. But they would far rather that American sons and daughters die for them than they themselves. They lack, shall we say, the courage of their convictions. And what they're scared to death of is that the violence and the chaos that is the mess that their boy, George Bush... I mean, remember the pictures with the holding the hands, walking through the bluebells and the kissing and the smooching? Remember? That's their guy. Here, let me go ahead and ruin the dialogue. George Bush is to the Saudis what Mussolini was to Hitler. Ew. But he is their boy in Washington. He's not our president. Anybody who thinks that he has any representative notion of the American people is sadly deluded. And now they're quietly warning George that we won't pull out. And what have you seen George? What have you seen George do in the last couple of days? We're not going to pull out until we have had a successful mission and democracy is established in Iraq. And this is all Al Qaeda's fault. I mean, I'm sure I don't have it because I'm sure somewhere along the way you heard the soundbite. George Bush said that this civil war that they won't call a civil war is Al Qaeda's fault. Now, every single strategist, every single logistician, every single anybody. Will tell you that the problems in Iraq are that anything approaching being Al Qaeda is less than 5% of the problem. We're being shoved around by the Saudis. The Saudis are telling George Bush that he may not leave Iraq. And screw it, it's not whether he leaves Iraq, it's whether some one-year-old's daddy gets to come home on his feet or feet first. But the Saudis do not care. Because American life to the Saudis is cheap, and I loathe and despise them for that. Let's go to the phones. Our good friend Jim joins us. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. You there, Jim?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you?
I hear you 5x5. Do you hear me?
I got you rock solid.
Good. Well, let's just face it. We've been stupid enough to allow the Saudis to get us to do their dirty work for them.
Yeah, and it's kind of embarrassing, isn't it?
Well, it's par for the course as far as I'm concerned. Particularly when you have the type of leadership in Washington that you have today and the type of president that you have today and quality or the lack of quality. And, you know, the Saudi Iraq, you know, as far as Iraq is concerned, de facto, Iraq ceased to be a country back in 2003.
Yeah.
It will never be any type of country. It was nothing but a cobbled together piece of territory anyway, and of course
it was a relic of 1919, wasn't it?
Basically, it was a British female cartographer who drew up Iraq, and it was in the post Versailles treaty era in the early 20s, I think, when Iraq was allowed to emerge as some type of cobbled together nation state of the Shias, the Sunnis, and the Kurds. And in my opinion, and I may be wrong, when Iraq, you know, implodes, one part's going to go to Turkey, one will go to Iran, and the other will go to Saudi Arabia, if the Saudis have the courage enough to go in there and invest part of it. I think it would be a great idea if we were to leave and let the Saudis handle the problem. And I can guarantee you, once the Saudi army gets involved in Iraq, the House of Saud won't have long.
Well, I think they know that, too.
And that's the reason they want us to stay there, because they realize that their days are numbered and that their position of hegemony there is predicated upon our continued presence and the acceleration of our presence by sending more and more people over there.
Well, you know, granted, they've got the oil, Jim, and that thing.
How long will that oil last?
Well, that's the thing. Why we didn't even have to be in this position. You know, Jimmy Carter warned us as far back as 1976 that we needed to get our stuff together, you know, but good, and get off the Middle Eastern oil Jones that we're on. We could have done that by now.
Well, but no one listened to Jimmy Carter. They called him Peanuts Carter. They called him a fool. They made fun of him because of his Christian faith, and they said that he was just too good a man to be president, and he had his head in the cloud and his feet in the mud, and nobody listened to him. He was, in fact, a prophet without honor in his own time, and you know this to be true.
Absolutely. And so, as a consequence of that, here in 2006, toward the tail end of the miserable year 2006, we've got the Saudis telling us we may not leave Iraq.
Well, Riyadh right now is running Washington, like it or not. And it will be, and it will continue to be, as long as George Bush is in the White House and his minions are able to control our policy. Now, when we tell them that this is over, this is not going to continue, then, you know, they're going to have to deal with it. And let's face it, we have a symbiotic relationship with Saudi Arabia. They need us, too.
Oh, yes, they do.
And they need us for manufactured goods, for all types of things. And, you know, they might be able to sell their oil to somebody else. But still, I think we are the principal customers of Saudi Arabia, and we have provided all the capital that has developed their country and pulled them out of tents on the floor of the desert into their modern gleaming alabaster cities, correct? Is
correct.
That so?
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I can tell you one thing, Riyadh isn't that whole, it's not a whole lot to look at, and you don't really want to go there on vacation. I can assure you of that.
Well, there are, you know, but there are issues beyond the military, Jim. You know, we had the audio the other night from the video shot by the American soldiers on the back of the truck, taunting, you know, maybe a 10-year-old Iraqi boy, you know, a peasant, just poor as poor can be, taunting him with a 1-liter bottle of water and making him run for upwards of a mile to get it following the truck.
Well, you know, American troops used to do that in France with candy and cigarettes during World War II.
Right, but there was the nylons and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They used to do they did that to the French.
But
French didn't forget it. And, you know, when I was in France, I heard stories about this and people in Paris who were, you know.
But there's an overarching thing here, Jim, too, and that is the poverty of the Iraqi people.
Look, when we went in there, Bob, and
the Saudis are rich beyond they're rich beyond our counting. The Kuwaitis are rich beyond our counting. They don't give a tinker's damn for the poor of Iraq.
No, they don't. And, you know, do we? Because, I mean, the first thing that they told us, or when they when the dust settled from all of our JDAMs and stuff like that, and our troops began to invest the country, the first question that the Iraqis were asking us were, when will the power come back on, and when will we have potable water? Those were the abiding questions that they were asking our troops. They weren't talking about freedom or whatever. They wanted to know when the lights would come back on and when the drinking water would be able to, you know, flow into their homes as it once did. And even that was at the very outset and the very day they were pulling down Saddam's statue. And, you know, that's something that, you know, we have neglected, because the infrastructure over there is my knowledge. Now, maybe you have better knowledge of the situation than I do. You probably do. But I don't think the infrastructure in Iraq is any better than it was 3 years ago, is it?
It is worse than the day that Saddam was deposed, by far.
I would think so. Because
and moreover, it's worse. It's worse on our accounts because going back to the Bush War One, we engaged in tactics and acts that are specifically forbidden by laws of international warfare. To wit, we bombed civilian infrastructure just like we did in Yugoslavia. We bombed electrical grids. We bombed water purification plants. We bombed everything that non-combatants need to survive.
Didn't Iraq have, like, the as far as ranking the fifth in grade as far as economies were concerned back in 2000?
Something on that.
I think it was right around the fifth or something like that. So for some reason that ordinal number comes to my mind, and I can't get it out of there. And I think it was.
But it kills me, Jim, because
now they're back into the Stone Age.
Oh gosh, yes. And the thing is, that's our doing, and it is our it was our willful doing. You know, we talk about, you know, George Bush in his, what was it, his 2003 State of the Union address. I want to tell the Iraqi people that we love them. You know, some tough love coming from that weird family. Jim, I got to roll on. I've got an interview scheduled here, but I hope we'll hear from you again and maybe flesh out this a little bit more.
All right. How long is your interview going to be?
I'm not sure. We'll see.
No,
we'll see where the conversation takes us.
Thank you, sir.
Take care, Jim. Bye now. As I said, I did schedule an interview for this evening, especially being as how it's prayer meeting night here on Head On. We are joined by Clint Borgen of the Borgen Project. It's borgenproject.org. Clint is a sort of... Clint, are you there?
I am.
Would you describe yourself as just a self-actualized or self-motivated poverty activist?
Yeah, I guess you could call that. Yeah, definitely.
you took a hard look at the world and didn't like what you saw, and you're taking the fight to Washington and around the world, trying to address poverty issues and issues of people suffering in poverty, and you've got a lot of people behind you, and you've made quite a little splash, and I applaud you for that. What is your take on the response of the United States government in particular? To the, I guess you'd call it issues of guns and butter.
Guns and butter, absolutely. well, definitely, I personally don't think we're doing near enough that we could be to address poverty. You look at the stats, just what we spend on defense compared to what, you know, the estimated cost of addressing some of these issues, and pretty phenomenal.
Well, I'm looking at a number here on your website. It costs us $4.4 billion to build two B-2 bombers with which we can slaughter untold countless numbers of poor people.
Yep, absolutely.
And the entire annual budget for the World Food Program is $3.2 billion.
Yeah, that's the largest relief agency in the world. They're able to assist 104 million starving, malnourished people. And interesting side note on the B-2 bomber, too. It's a very controversial plane. A strong lobby in the defense industry that's kept that plane around quite a while now, despite the fact it's not really necessary in today's modern wars. But, there's a great deal of, you know, tremendous influence on the defense industry. There's not a great deal... It's not a lot of influence in kind of poverty reduction side of things, and that's kind of the Borgen Project's form to kind of create a little more political push for some of these issues.
Well, tell us about the genesis of the project itself, Clint.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the bottom line is we're a lobby for poverty issues. We're trying to lobby to get greater political attention going to severe poverty. Our main issue is called the Millennium Development Goals. What it is, it's essentially a plan to end world hunger that was agreed to in 2000 by the largest gathering of world leaders. There's a big UN summit in New York City. Every nation on Earth signed on to it, including the United States. The plan is to cut hunger in half by 2015, with the idea that they'll go on to completely abolish it by 2025. And we're talking about, you know, severe hunger. Your broader poverty is a little more complicated to address. But definitely malnutrition, hunger, that stuff, you know, no reason for being around anymore.
Well, so, I saw in a story, I guess, in the last week that the Bush administration has removed hunger from its descriptors for people who don't have enough food to eat. I don't know if you saw that or not, but now they're called food resource challenged, I believe.
Yeah, they're definitely very good at their word choicing and changing words. A recent summit, they tried to remove all mention of the Millennium Development Goals from a, you know, recent summit. So they're definitely well aware of the more they can kind of keep the issue behind the scenes, the less pressure there is from the public to actually do something. So,
do you have any data as to, because this is a, despite all the problems we have in the United States, Clint, this is still a pretty well-off nation. Do you have any data to paint a better picture of what it is that constitutes hunger per se?
As far as like your severe hunger, or
yeah,
more locally. Are you looking for just like what looks like for the average person living in it, or what?
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between I'd like to have a cheeseburger and I can't have it for 45 minutes, and you know I haven't had food for 5 days.
Sure, absolutely. Some of these really poor countries, it gets down to everything from, you know, to go to the hospital, it's a 2-day walk, and then, you know, the chance of actually getting medical treatment, often there's lines. They'll be sent home, just walk back. You know, it's just everything from getting water. Water's often like a 5-mile walk. Just your absolute basic human needs that we take so for granted. It's an absolute, just trying to survive every day is an absolute struggle. You know, all their energy goes to just water, trying to find food, and, you know, these are issues that we definitely, even our severe poverty in the United States, it's kind of out, it's a whole new realm, I guess you might say.
Where are there, have you identified places where it is the absolute worst places on Earth?
Yeah, with Africa is the big one right now, and then especially like the Horn of Africa, Congo, more Central Africa. I mean, Africa as a whole is just absolute chaos right now. There's been a lot of progress in Asia. China actually cut hunger in half during the 1990s. So there's been all sorts of progress. There's different pockets of progress. Vietnam's been one of the success stories. India, we're seeing a lot of improvement there. But Africa kind of remains just you know, the big problem right now.
I'm trying to formulate this question, and I'm trying to formulate it without being too ugly about it, not to you, but is there a component in this that the developed world is able to somehow look away from Africa because, is there a racial component?
Great question. I get that one a lot. It's really hard to say. I would definitely say without question, your average American has more trouble relating to someone from Africa than maybe someone from the Balkans or more European-looking countries. How much of that is racism versus just that human nature of the more we identify with different types of people, the more likely we are to actually help them. So, you look at the data, we're not funding Africa without question. So it's hard to say how much that's racism versus maybe some more less sinister human.
You plain old-fashioned ignorance?
Right, exactly, yeah.
What part does the absence of these issues in our daily lives, in media, newspapers, what part does that play in the willingness of the world to simply let a significant portion of the population of said world die from starvation?
So that's a big part. I mean, that's one of the great issues that faces organizations like the Borden Project, is just trying to, anyone who's been to these countries, there's this instant sense of the United States needs to be doing more. You know, you never meet relief workers or people who've been to these countries that think the U.S. is doing enough. That being said, people who, you know, are here and they're not exposed to it as much, there's definitely a lack of, I don't think you relate to the images as much as you would if you're actually there. So that's without question a huge component of all this.
So are you actively advocating, say, and in some corners of this country, it's heresy to suggest a reduction in defense spending in favor of poverty eradication?
I personally absolutely do. I mean, you look at the stats, we're now spending more than half of what the United States spends is equal to what the rest of the world combined spends. There's so much corruption in the defense budget. It's like, where do you begin on? We're just spending, we're being overcharged for stuff, for buying stuff the military did not request, did not want. But there's so much, Congress has so much influence in earmarking different bills and getting funding in there that, you know, it has absolutely nothing to do with defense. It's all politics. So we, without question, we could have drastic reduction in military spending, still have extremely strong military, and, you know, use that money to address all these different issues that are affecting both the United States and the world abroad.
Well, what kind of progress are you making?
We're getting the meeting. We're able to talk to, when I go back to D.C., pretty much all the top congressional offices, everyone from Senator Bill Frist's office to Congressman Dennis Hastert, you know, the most powerful people in Congress are talking to the Borden Project. So it's been really, you know, it's been pretty exciting to see this kind of force for poverty reduction kind of emerge. You know, it's really just occurred over the last 3 years. We started developing 3 years ago, and it's just kind of off and running. So we're really pleased with the direction we're heading.
Obviously, you are the visible face of the Borden Project. Who else is behind this?
We got a great board of advisors. They range from one's a former NBC Nightly News producer, one's a former Dow Jones columnist. We get different people who have political backgrounds, who've worked with political offices. So, but a lot of different people involved, and it's going the right direction. We like where we're going.
Do you hold out any greater hope for your efforts with the change in the congressional majority?
Yeah, we do. We really do. we're a nonpartisan organization, but there's definitely a bill we've been really pushing, H.R. 3605, the Global Poverty Act. Anyone out there listening who wants to contact our House of Representatives and ask them to co-sponsor this, we'd greatly appreciate it. But this is a bill that we had a great deal of resistance with the previous Congress. We're pretty excited about the new Congress and what that might do to get this bill through.
In turn, you said, you know, folks can contact their representatives. How can people get involved with your project itself?
Sure, absolutely. If you go to the Borgen Project website, borgenproject.org, there's a Get Involved section, and that's a great place to start. We have all sorts of suggestions on what things people can do. The big thing we're really pushing right now is we really need people calling their congressional offices, asking them to increase funding for poverty reduction. It's one of those, I don't really come from an activist background. I didn't realize how important a lot of stuff is. Spending time in a lot of these political offices like I do now, it's absolutely amazing how receptive political leaders are to public opinion. And we often find ourselves in situations in different districts where we just need, you know, four or five people from that district to contact the congressional leader and ask them to co-sponsor a bill or do this or that, and they will. Like, it's absolutely amazing how receptive even some of your political leaders you might think would be, you know, more corrupt or not necessarily prone to caring what the public thinks. Bottom line is their business. They get reelected by keeping the public happy. Real easy way to do that is responding to what people are contacting them on. So it's absolutely kind of amazed me how receptive they are to public opinion and how much just a person picking up the phone, making a 30 second phone call, what that does for these issues.
And I noted somewhere on the website you assert that not that many people actually do take any form of activism with regard to their elected representatives by calling or writing or emailing. It's a very small effort that can have a very great yield, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, we all see those email forms that go around. Those are interesting. Every office works differently. A lot of them keep tally of how many times people contact them on an issue. You know, say 100 people contact them saying pull out of Iraq, 100 people contact them saying stay in Iraq. They keep the tally of that. The information is viewed by the congressional leader and the top staffers. Another thing is, like, a lot of times I'll be sitting there waiting for a meeting in the lobby of these offices, and the person answering the phone, I'll be amazed. Like, they'll go 10 minutes without answering the phone at all, then they'll answer, and maybe it's a, you know, constituent wanting this or that, and they write it down, they put it in their computer database, and the information is used by different people. But, I mean, literally, I'll sit there sometimes 10 minutes at a time, and the phone won't ring at all. So it's really kind of amazing. Just, you know, we really encourage people to put the phone numbers of their congressional leaders in their cell phones or different things like that. If you're sitting in traffic, you're bored, it's a quick 30-second activity to kind of get the issues on their radar and help create that sense of public pressure.
How realistic is it for us to believe that that something as pervasive as poverty throughout the world is eradicable?
It's extremely realistic. The big thing to remember, too, over the last 20 years, hunger has been cut in half. Severe hunger, we're talking about, you know, undernourishment, that's been cut in half for the last 20 years. There's just so many instances of success. The strategies out there for addressing are absolutely phenomenal. Really not that complicated issue. We're talking about people have absolutely nothing, improving life for them. It's not that complicated. But the big thing that I can't stress enough is the Millennium Development Goals is agreed to by every world leader on Earth in 2000, including the United States. Bill Clinton was there and signed it. The Russians were there. I mean, everybody was there. All these world leaders agreed to this plan to cut hunger in half by 2015 with the idea of abolishing it by 2025. You have every government on the planet agreeing to this plan to cut hunger in half, and that's a pretty good endorsement that hunger is definitely an issue that we can be addressing right now.
What role does, first of all, obviously, you have to feed hungry people.
Sure.
But secondly, you have to make hungry people able to feed themselves, too, don't you?
Yeah.
What level does education play in this?
It's huge. Like, a lot of the strategies we're talking about and we're pushing and we're the funding we're fighting for, it's less aid-focused. It gets in everything from one of the really popular things right now. It's called microloans, and it's basically really small loans for really poor people. A woman's loaned $100 so she can buy an oven. She's then able to bake bread and earn income by selling that bread in the village. It also increases the village's food supply. So, you know, now she's able to feed her family and earn income, and all these good things start to happen.
Well, Well, that was the Nobel Prize winning founder of the Grameen Bank, wasn't it?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. So it's getting a lot of attention right now. It's really popular. Both sides of the aisle seem to be pretty receptive to it. That's definitely an issue we're looking to push more in the coming year. But there's just so many great strategies out there. Education is a huge component. The longer people stay in school, the less likely they're to have unplanned pregnancies, less likely to get different diseases, more likely to have food, too. I mean, it just there's just numerous strategies. I can't stress that enough.
Do you run up against any problems, Clint, in terms of these people with whom I profoundly disagree, I might add, who are opposed to population control in terms of contraceptives for women, planned pregnancy, that kind of thing? Is that a sticking point in this fight?
We haven't run into too much of that yet. Primarily, we haven't gotten too much in that issue as far as birth control and those different issues too much ourselves, so we haven't had too much encounters with that. That's definitely been, I know, with the administration, that's one of their big sticking points.
Well, let me ask you another facet of this. We being a very liberal, very progressive program and a very liberal, very progressive network, we focus a lot on what happens to working people, because just because you've got a job somewhere in the world doesn't mean you're not hungry, and it doesn't mean you're not facing starvation, and it doesn't mean you're not living in the midst of economic and environmental blight. What can, for instance, labor organization and social justice do in terms of these goals?
I would really encourage them to lobby. I mean, I can't. I'm like become such a true believer in like people contacting their congressional leaders. If anyone with any sort of influence scheduling meetings with their congressional leaders, your average citizen, anyone can do it. Like, you really don't have to be a lobbyist or anything. You can request meetings with people that people represent you. That would be the thing I'd stress, is just that the more people are breathing down the throat of political leaders, the more they feel they're overwhelmed by the issue and they know they need to address to keep voters happy. So we just need to have that constant bombarding them with the issue.
Does the United States' reliance on cheap foreign goods play into any of this, Clint, to the extent that, for all I know, I'm wearing a shirt right now that may have been sewn by somebody in Kuala Lumpur who makes 3 cents a day.
Yeah.
Does globalism play into this?
It does. It's hard to say where and when or what different roles, because there's been an interesting trend emerge over the last 3 years. A lot of the business community now wants global poverty to be a top priority of the administration. I'm out of Seattle. There's a group out here called Initiative for Global Development. And it's, every CEO you can think of, from the Starbucks CEO to the Delta Airlines CEO, they've been lobbying the White House to address global poverty, do more to address it. They're looking at it from a business standpoint. The world's poor represent the largest untapped market on Earth as people transition from barely surviving into being able to purchase, American goods and products. That's great business for the United States. So there's definitely some businesses that they have benefited from poverty. There's a lot more realizing that as the issues are addressed and U.S. businesses have their foot in the door in some of these countries, the economic impact in the United States is pretty amazing. And we're seeing this already in China and India and some of the different countries that as their populations get wealthier, they're buying more and more U.S. goods and products.
What does a poverty-free, and I'm not trying to be overly simplistic, Clint,
sure,
what does a poverty-free world look like to you? Is there a point at which we say, yes, we've won?
Great question. I haven't thought that far ahead. Like, we're definitely, I would say, with the severe poverty, which is, it could be such a quick victory to get the hunger addressed, that one will be easier to measure our impact and where we've won. The issue we have right now in the United States, there'll be an ongoing fight, is just the fact, like you talked about, the working poor. There's people who work very hard in this country and who make very little money, kind of scraping by. So that's an issue that's going to be longer to address and harder to measure, but I think the hunger issue we can see.
Well, I remember the story that came out, 6 months ago, about Bill Gates saying that he had decided to give away many of his billions to eliminate disease in the world.
Yeah.
There's a symbiosis between education, disease, hunger, the ability of people to support themselves on their own soil.
Yeah.
It truly is a multifaceted problem that is going to require the participation of people on everything from the simplest to the most complex levels, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's also intertwined. You look at some of these countries where they don't have sanitation. They don't have, some of these basic things like running water and toilet, sewage that we take for granted, and diseases grow, that also leads to poverty because, you know, your farmers are dying, your teachers are dying, they're not educating the kids. And, they're very, very intertwined. That's a great point.
Do you have a timeline? Do you have a goal? What you want to have happen and when? I mean, you mentioned House Bill 3605. Does it have a counterpart in the Senate? Do you want to see it passed by June? When? What? How?
Right. Yeah, we're shooting for probably around May or June. That's definitely a huge priority. The other one is just the funding. Funding always comes down to funding, like how much are they willing to allocate towards poverty reduction. So that's just a constant battle. But we take it one bill at a time, and ultimately, like, just the more they're hearing from us on us and citizens and different people on the issue, the more higher profile the issue becomes. And that's really our main focus right now, is just constantly bombarding with the issue and then definitely taking it one bill at a time.
Well, I really love the way that you're approaching some of this, because it's a terribly, painfully serious issue, but you also recognize the nature of the activism you're trying to inspire. I'm sitting here looking at the Slacker's Guide to Saving the World.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just so many...
Are you writing from experience? Or?
I absolutely am. Like, I would definitely consider myself a person who didn't think any of this activism stuff mattered whatsoever. I've become a 100% true believer after spending time on Capitol Hill and meeting with different political leaders. We have a lot of people operating, you know, in congressional offices that are friendly to the cause and give us great advice. And it just absolutely amazes me how the simple stuff, like the 30-second phone call, you know, putting their cell phone ever pushing, just the huge impact stuff like that has. And it's just so unbelievably simple, but there's just this huge gap between the public thinking there's nothing they can do and, like, groups like us absolutely, you know, pulling our hair out, trying to get people to, you know, pick up their phone every once a week and make a 30-second phone call. So it's kind of fascinating.
And all those resources are linked, again, at BorgenProject.org, correct?
Yep, absolutely.
Clint Borgen, I wish you the absolute best success. I hope that your appearance here will boost your efforts a little bit. I hope folks will get behind the effort to compel our elected representatives to take a stand on this, when we can spend, what, $300 million every how often blow the snot out of Iraq. It seems almost a token gesture to try to stop people from starving that we're not actively killing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's still to our own best interest to do this, too, so...
Well, that's absolutely the truth. Anybody who bothers to learn a little bit of history will know that to be a fact. I hope you'll keep us posted on your efforts, and let us know any more that we can do to help, Clint.
Absolutely. I appreciate that, Bob. Thank you.
My pleasure. Best of luck.
Thanks.
Bye now. Clint Borgen, BorgenProject.org. Go by. Have a look. This is an approach to activism that I think you'll find refreshing. It's not so much about having a handout and saying, give us money. They don't want your money so much as they want your effort and they want your time. And, you know, I can't find an argument with going forward on a bill like I read a little bit about it, HB 3605. You can read about it, too, if you click the Get Involved button at BorgenProject.org. You can then click on a link that says Learn More About the Global Poverty Act. And, of course, he's right insofar as a surcease to misery in the rest of the world benefits us in ways that we may not well be able to fully comprehend. It's time for us to have a run at the news. You want to get involved in the program? Come to the front of the Cathedral of Common Sense and issue a big hallelujah? Do so, please. 877-443-2366. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid. Read a story to my baby. I'm a West Virginia man. I work in a sawmill 8 hours a day. He suffered, read the paper, put up 100 bales of hay. Run off a batch of moonshine, relax next to the fan. Shoot it back, I sing a fine song. I'm a West Virginia man, West Virginia man. All right, I hate it. All right.
This is the Quality News Network. The summit between President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in Jordan today has been pushed back to Thursday. In today's New York Times, a confidential memo written by National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley after his recent trip to Iraq raised doubts about al-Maliki's leadership. The White House said the delay was not related to the memo leak. As expected to protest the meeting, Iraqi cabinet members loyal to anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shiite, suspended their participation in the parliament. In Iraq today, fighting in Bakuba shut down the city as coalition forces battled insurgents. The U.S. military said 8 suspected al-Qaeda members were killed and 2 Iraqi women were killed as well. Also, the U.S. military reported 2 more American soldiers died in Iraq. To increase security, the U.S. military will move at least 3 more army battalions into Baghdad, according to a Pentagon official. That is around 3,000 troops. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell is calling the situation in Iraq a civil war. The White House refuses to characterize it as such. He adds that world leaders should accept that reality. Pope Benedict continued his first visit to Turkey today. He is seeking dialogue between faiths. Al-Qaeda in Iraq called the Pope's visit part of a, quote, crusader campaign against Islam. 2 British Airways planes at London's Heathrow Airport have tested positive for radiation traces. A 3rd plane is under examination. The testing is in connection with the poisoning death in London of Alexander Litvinenko, a critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. On Capitol Hill, in the opening weeks of the new 110th Congress, Democrats plan to revive the embryonic stem cell funding bill that President Bush vetoed, the first veto of his presidency. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist announced today that he will not run for president in 2008. The U.S. is cracking down on the sale of luxury products to North Korea, such as iPods and plasma televisions. The trade sanctions are meant to personally aggravate North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-il, who recently conducted a nuclear weapons test. 2 days before Mexico's president-elect Felipe Calderón will be sworn in, there was a brawl in the legislature's chambers. Leftist lawmakers may try to disrupt the inauguration ceremony. And Cuba's leader Fidel Castro is reportedly too sick to attend celebrations for his 80th birthday. You are listening to the Quality News Network.
Huelhauser talks to customers of First National, South Valley, and San Benito Banks, local members of the network of preferred community banks.
We're here to talk with people about their business banking. Here's a guy who not only banks at the bank, he helped build the bank building.
Yes, sir.
Do you find the fact that it's a local bank appealing?
Yes, that's just it. It was the local people in the community that originally started the bank, and that's why I got involved.
It's a local bank with big bank benefits. It's part of a network of banks. Does that mean anything to you?
Absolutely. Having a bank that can handle a big project really helps because some banks aren't tailored to handle big business, and they can handle the big business for sure. They have no limitations to what they can do for your business.
I do my business banking and my personal banking with them.
Both.
Absolutely.
You're double dipping.
You bet.
Above and beyond banking from the network of preferred community banks. Available locally at First National Bank of Central California, South Valley National Bank, and San Benito Bank.
Researchers in Amsterdam have found that even first-time users of the popular recreational drug ecstasy experience memory problems and decreased blood flow to the brain. It is not yet clear if this brain damage is permanent. Ford announced that nearly half of its hourly production workers, or 38,000, have agreed to buyouts or early retirement offers. Drug manufacturer Pfizer will cut 2,200 jobs from its U.S. sales force, or about 20%. The cuts are part of a cost-cutting program and will be made by the end of the year. One of the nation's largest textbook publishers, Houghton Mifflin, will be bought out for nearly $2 billion by a publishing executive. The new company will be called HM River Group. A federal judge has now ruled that a newspaper alliance involving the San Francisco Chronicle and several papers owned by the Media News Group may violate antitrust laws. A judge has ruled that paper money is unfair to blind people. The federal judge said the Treasury Department must come up with ways to differentiate the bill so that the blind can tell them apart. And San Diego City Council voted to ban certain large retail stores such as Walmart Supercenters. The mayor is expected to veto the ban. Light sweet crude is trading at $62.38 a barrel. And at the close of Wall Street today, the Dow was up 90 points. The NASDAQ was up 20 points. The S&P 500 up 13. There's always more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramoff.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
All right, then. It's only fair to tell you I am operating the controls right now. I'm behind the board and the microphone and taking your calls at 877-443-2366. So if you just get abruptly told, hey, who's calling? That's because there's no one here to screen. Agnes has had to go back into the mansion to deal with a couple of kid-related issues. We got kids, you know. I mean, it's part of what makes this zany and fun and exciting and everything that everything you want in radio that's real. Real American radio. That's what we're doing here at the Horn, by Jove. So what we will do right now is go straight to the phones. Our good friend Susan is calling in from Columbia City, Oregon. Susan, welcome to the program. Thank you for calling.
Bob.
How are you?
Well, for a prayer meeting, how come you keep getting me so mad?
we're getting you in the spirit, Susan.
Yeah, well, first of all, I was trained as a medical biller and coder, which means I know what gets paid and how much.
Okay.
The next time some idiot doctor, and I admit most of them are idiots, I've fired more than my share, tells you, no, we can't do that. We don't do that here because his Medicare won't cover it. Tell him, back squeeze. The only thing that determines what Medicare covers is a little goodie called medical necessity.
Exactly. Well, yeah.
If
it's medically necessary, it's payable.
Yeah. And the doctor was lying. He was being a twit.
Well, I think he was getting his job, you know. His little hackles went up as soon as I said something relating to universal health care.
Yeah, that's when you mentioned the word lawyer.
Well, I was a little, I got to admit, I was a little loath to play that card so early on simply because my father wasn't out from under his care yet.
Well, sometimes they need to actually do it even and then yell for replacement. Secondly, the Saudis.
Sorry, I know I was over the top on that.
No, you weren't. Bob, if I wanted a monarchy, I'd still be part of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's...
I wouldn't be part of a empire or a monarchy that treats women like dogs. Actually, they treat the dogs better.
Yeah, the dogs have it better. The dogs don't have to wear burkas or abayas or whatever the hell they call them in Saudi Arabia.
I object to the whole culture. They're trapped back in the 12th or 14th century. I'm not interested. And I resent some monarchist coming over here and telling me what to do. Hey, we went through a revolution over that. Now, if they want another one, I can oblige them.
But you see, I think the Bush administration, Susan, has given the Saudis some impression that they are a form of monarchy. I think they've given the Saudis to understand that the Bushes consider themselves some level of royalty to us.
The closest we ever came to royalty was Jack Kennedy and his wife. And that was because the American people said, yeah, these people will nominate it for it. But only because, hey, they gave the American government what it never had before, majesty. Even in the act of burying John Kennedy, they came up with class. Let's face it, Bush is nothing but a low-class hick.
Well, I've referred to them on a number of occasions as welfare the real welfare trash.
Well,
There's
trailer trash, yeah.
Well, no, I got friends who live in trailers, so I won't do that.
Okay, poor white trash.
Yeah, we're getting there. But honest to God, the Bush family has never made a nickel that wasn't somehow associated with sucking money out of the taxpayer's pocket.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm offended by the notion of calling something welfare when poor people get it. Because poor people work harder than just about anybody else in this country.
Yeah. You know that old stereotype of, quote, welfare queen?
Mm-hmm.
The Bush family is the ultimate in welfare queens.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Susan, because I've had this notion rattling around in my tiny little skull space for a few days now. Ever since I read the story about the Bush twins being politely asked to get the hell out of Argentina, and it started something going that was like, you know, the pee under the mattress. It was just annoying, and that's a PEAP. But it boils down to this. There are nearly 3,000 American men and women dead in Iraq, probably closer to 10,000 dead because of the way they keep the statistics. There are some probably on the order of 30,000 to 40,000 profoundly maimed and wounded out of that war of choice.
So these girls could go out and party and get drunk and get drugged up.
And right, and there is a certain minimum standard of decorum that I think the American people have a right to demand.
Exactly.
And no, they didn't ask their daddy to run, and they didn't run to be first daughter or anything like that. I understand all that. But, you know, they want to be royal, and it is damned well time that if they're going to try to adopt that they learn to act the part.
Now, the first thing the British royal family is taught is noblesse oblige.
Yeah, and of course you also get Rudyard Kipling and his White Man's Burden and all of that.
Exactly.
But these little twits, globe hopping and hanging out and partying in it's unseemly somehow. Does that make sense?
It's very unseemly. It is tacky beyond belief. And then the Saudi royal, you know, I'm just like you. I won't forget 9/11 any more than I'll forget John Kennedy's death, Bobby Kennedy's death. It's one of those traumatic things you never forget. You never forgive it.
No. And you know.
I'm looking at Saudi Arabia. I'm not looking at Afghanistan or Iraq.
No, our problems on September 11th started in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
A bunch of people in Afghanistan who have been bombed back to the Stone Age by the Russians, they're too busy trying to survive to worry about coming over and bombing us. The people who came over and hit us came out of Saudi Arabia. They came out of the upper middle class. The middle class, no. They weren't some poor Afghani or some Iraqi didn't have anything to do with it.
No, of course not. And that's what bothers me so much out of this. When have the Saudis ever moved to do anything except save their own hide?
Yeah.
You know, they're more than, and it's the idea as I said, that some princeling would tell George Bush, well, you can't leave Iraq. Not that George has any intention of doing it because he's not that smart. But you can't leave Iraq because, after all, you've got to take care of us.
Yeah. And, you know, I know for a fact, I don't know about an army, but I do know for a fact that Saudi Arabia has a really spiffy air force because we gave it to them.
Yeah, we did. We built an entire air base, and then after September 11th, when Osama sent his letter out and said, look it, get your butts off of our sacred sand, George Bush said, how quickly? And we were gone. We don't have a military presence in Saudi Arabia anymore.
But the Saudis have this really spiffy air force, and I don't see them flying any missions over Iraq.
Oh, no. They expressly won't, because... Yeah, they want nothing to do with it.
Okay, in that case, they have nothing to say with the decision. As far as I'm concerned, I keep having this word over and over in my head, disengage, disengage, disengage. Get out. Get out.
Yeah, leave. Frankly, if this thing is going to be brought to some sort of reasonable conclusion, it is more likely to be brought to a reasonable conclusion with a multinational Arab-speaking force than it is with a bunch of American kids who can't get past Howdy.
Yeah. And, you know, I got the Vietnam War shoved in my face every day along with my dinner when I was a kid. When you've seen one 18-year-old kid crying for his mama because he's been gut shot, it doesn't matter if he's in a filthy jungle or in a desert. He's still just a little boy who's going to die.
He's some mother's son.
Yeah.
And now, you know, of course, some mother's daughters die over there, too.
And it's still wrong.
Some mother's daughters commit suicide over there rather than participate in torture.
Or they go to jail.
Yeah, or they go to jail after they complain about being raped.
Uh-huh. Or they go to jail because they say, no, I'm not going to do this. This is wrong. And I honor those men and women because they are the upright ones. They are the ones who have a true moral sense. They have said, no. And I will go to jail if that is what it is.
Well,
and more and more and more and more of them are doing just that.
The trial of Lieutenant Aaron Watata is coming up.
Yeah, and they're going to send him to jail.
Oh, yeah. Hard time. Hard time.
Yeah.
6 years.
And it's wrong, but I honor him. And there's not much I can do for him because not exactly the world's richest person.
No, but we can do for him by mentioning him, by talking about him, by remembering him, and trying to bring him to the forefront of American consciousness.
And not only that, because of me, my congressional delegation knows him very well. And they will continue to know him. And everybody listening should also have their congressional delegates. I don't care if they're Republicans, Democrats, or not. It doesn't matter. You call them up and you say, putting this man in jail, being honorable, is wrong.
Well, it absolutely is.
Yes. I just got an email that the grandson of a friend of mine, who should have been out a long time ago, he's been stopped off. He's going back to Iraq. Again.
Oh, God.
Yeah. He's a medic. So naturally, of course, they need him.
Sure they do. And they now more than ever.
It's just sickening. It's wrong. We need to get out. I don't care if it's just a matter of, okay, we pick up our toys and leave.
Well, you know, again, give the Iraqis a choice. I mean, for God's sakes, why can't they just vote on it, Susan?
Well, I agree with you. I think it's a wonderful idea. Get out the purple ink, say yes or no, and then we abide by this decision and pack up our toys and leave.
Because there's not a chance in hell of it being a please stay vote.
Oh yeah, heavens no. You know, we're going to end up paying massive reparations anyway. Because let's face it, we ruined that country.
Yeah. In any just world, yeah. But, no, I don't know that we'll pay massive reparations. I don't know that there's anybody out there that can make us pay reparations, Susan. That's the thing. Did you read the letter from Ahmadinejad?
No, I haven't had a chance to yet.
It's addressed to noble Americans, of course. And, you know, you look at the guy's photograph and you think, you know, he doesn't look like a crazy guy. He's an engineer. You know, no necktie. You know, it's out of the photo, but he's probably got a pocket protector.
And this guy's writing to the United States, talking about, chiming in on what the elections meant. And I have read a bunch of right-wing stuff on this. How dare he? How dare he tell us what we and say that blah 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 blah. You know, it's largely a conciliatory piece of writing. The only problem is, he's as religiously insane as the right-wing Republicans are.
Right.
And that's, you know, I don't distrust him because he's Iranian. I distrust him because he's religiously insane and thinks that some invisible thing in the sky talks to him.
But by the same token, if he wants to make peace overtures to the United States and keep his religious nutcases at home, hey, I'll talk to him.
Sure. And that's the business.
That's what I mean. It's his country. If he wants to be crazy, it's his country.
And, you know, John Bolton, I saw a bit of John Bolton today on television. Well, and him with his walrus mustache.
Yeah, we need to get rid of him.
Yeah, he's got to go. This is not credible. What? Is that the only... Oh, this isn't credible. I don't believe it. Yeah.
He's not credible. He's the president of Iran. What more do they want? A message from God?
Well, there's that.
God. Mine, Iran, the Christians, whose?
Well, you know what's...
Mine is female.
Yeah, right.
I don't think they're going to listen to mine.
Oh, but it's just... We got to get out, Susan. Just got to get out.
Yeah, we need to get out. I don't care how we do it. We need to just pick up our stuff and leave, if necessary. Just leave.
You know, and bring in 500,000 Kuwaitis and Saudis and Jordanians and Egyptians.
Uh-huh.
And admit that we screwed up.
Yeah.
But see, that's the toughest part of it, because the thing that stands in the way of all of this is the fact that we can't admit that we screwed up. Or not we can't, but George Bush can't.
Never mind the fact that the entire world knows we've screwed up.
Yeah. So...
It's the fact that George Bush can't say, I screwed up. Hey, George, everybody knows you blew it. In stage, give it up. What's really funny is there's one section of that country where they're not going to need any peacekeepers, and that's where the Kurds are. They're heads. They're going great guns. As far as I've been able to find out, they're having it. They're doing just great.
Well, and by all means, let's have a great big media orgy debate on whether or not we can call it civil war yet.
If you look at your history, we had a lot less government involvement in our civil war, and nobody takes any exception with us calling it the Civil War. Unless, of course, you live in the Deep South, and then it was the late unpleasantness.
No. Oh. It was the War of Northern Aggression.
Sorry. Hey, I'm a Yankee, what can I say?
Yeah, well, you know, but we love you anyway.
I'm glad somebody needs to love me.
Susan.
I'm going to let you go.
Okay, thank you so much. You take care.
Great night, and I hope your dad gets better.
Thank you very kindly. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our good friend Susan in Columbia City, Oregon, another of our news bloggers at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, who does just tremendous yeoman work. In the conversation that we had before the top of the hour, the issue of compassion sort of came to the fore, and why we seem to be so profoundly willing to ignore the hell and the misery that is the entire continent of Africa. And it reminded me of something that I read a couple of days ago, namely that a survey was taken. Now, none of you are going to be surprised by this. Of course, I'm sure the right wing is screaming, it's liberal bias. But a scientific survey was taken, and fundamentalist evangelicals and generally right wing freaks are less able to give a damn about people who suffer from HIV/AIDS. Now, you and I, we're moderately intelligent people, so as a consequence, we know that you don't have to have had gay sex to get HIV/AIDS anymore. There's an entire continent full of people who were born with it now. And we're not going to get into the fact that, the Pope with the red shoes who's gone to Turkey. We're not going to get into the fact that he believes that using condoms in Africa is a sin, even though it would stop the spread of this misery. We're not going to get into that. But no, time after time after time, in this study, people who turned out to be right-wingers were asked, well, what do you think about people who have AIDS? And they go, don't care. Don't care. So, you know, it's time for us to, you know, and these studies are coming out with more regularity. We're finding out that there is something profoundly wrong with the right wing. These are sick people. Okay? Another one that has come out, a new study by Christopher Lose, who is a student, a social work master's degree student at Southern Connecticut State University. Lose said, he put together a study and says that he has proven, wait for it, a direct link between mental illness and support for George Bush. Yeah, really. A link between mental illness and George Bush. He says his study is quite serious. It was a survey of 69 psychiatric outpatients in three Connecticut locations during the 2004 presidential election. And he was backed up with a statistician and a senior psychology professor. And they found a direct correlation between the severity of a person's psychosis and their preference for George Bush. The sicker and crazier they were, that's just a really bad way of putting it, but the more likely they were to vote for and or support George Bush. But of course, that's nothing new. If you've read, as I have, the little book written by our good friend Rick Goodner, called The Fox Syndrome, Shared Psychotic Disorder, in which he identifies as a mental illness one's willingness to spend any time at all watching Fox News Channel, this won't be news to you. And what was the study a few years ago that caused such an uproar in Berkeley, where out of Berkeley, where it was discovered, and this was a years-long, decades-long study, that whiny, cryy, cranky little children turned into conservatives when they grew up, if you could call it growing up. Remember that? Well, it turns out that while this study was set upon not with a goal of proving what it did, it was a simple inquiry, and that's the way the answers came out. And it using this modified general assessment functioning MGAF, it turns out that people who are mentally ill have generally